Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Great Hall of the Cooper Union and to the John J. Islin Memorial Lecture. J. Islin was the 10th president of the Cooper Union. Following a distinguished career in journalism, publishing, and public television, he's the man who brought Big Bird to public television, along with many other wonderful programs as president of Channel 13. Those of you who've been here for the previous two lectures know that our speaker, Professor Bert Newborn, is the Inez Milholland Professor of Civil Liberties at New York University. He's had a long 45-year career as a litigant in defense of civil liberties in practically every forum in the land, but particularly in the United States Supreme Court. And it is a distinguished honor to hear him this evening. And let me just remind you all that if you have any electronic devices less vital than a pacemaker, please turn them off now. Professor Newborn.
Thank you all for coming. It's good to see you. And thanks again to Lee Islin for making these lectures possible in memory of her husband, Jay, who, as you've just heard, served with great distinction as president of Cooper Union and who played such an important role in the development of public television. In lecture one, I sketched out my understanding of the role that a justice's values must and should play in deciding hard constitutional cases where the text is ambiguous and the precedents point in different directions. I suggested that Republican and Democratic justices would tend to hold characteristically different value hierarchies, generally involving the relative status of autonomy versus equality, stability versus change, and order versus risk. And that the use of such characteristically different value hierarchies to break constitutional ties would lead over time to distinctly Republican and distinctly Democratic constitutions that would be, in the end, judged by the people through a process of indirect democracy. And if you take a look at this week's New York Review of Books, you'll see that Cass Sunstein makes the same point. I just want the record to note, I made it first. I suggested as well that most cases were governed by a consensus constitution because either the text was clear, the precedents compelling, or the values in play were widely shared, rendering it unnecessary for a justice to use her own values to break a constitutional tie. Last week, I tried to apply that formula to the various Supreme Court cases that have shaped American democracy over the last 50 years, and suggested to you that mostly Republican constitutional decisions had left us with a dysfunctional democracy that was in very serious need of reform, especially campaign finance reform. Next week, I'm going to try to use the same analytic lens to look at the religion clauses, to talk about divine madness and how the religion clauses operate in both the Republican, Democratic, and consensus constitutions. And for those of you who can think that far in advance, I write it down. For those of you who can think that far in advance in your head, the week after that, I'm going to try to do the Second Amendment, how the Second Amendment fits in, the right to bear arms amendment fits in. Tonight, though, I propose to consider our three free speech First Amendments, the Republican First Amendment, the Democratic First Amendment, and the consensus First Amendment. I confess, though, that in preparing the lecture, I had to make a choice between two types of very different lectures. One lecture would survey the evolution of First Amendment law and theory from the original 19th century bad tendency test permitting censorship of speech merely because it had a bad tendency to cause harm. Through the great Holmes Brandeis dissents in the 1920s, breaking with the bad tendency test, through the unfortunate 1951 Supreme Court decision in Dennis that used the bad tendency test to uphold the convictions of leaders of the American Communist Party, through the crucial 1969 and 1971 decisions in Brandenburg versus Ohio and Cohn versus California that formally abandoned the bad tendency test and installed instead the modern clear and present danger test, requiring government to prove not merely a bad tendency, but to prove that it has a compelling interest in preventing speech that would almost certainly lead to imminent harm. I mean, for example, Brandenburg refused to permit the prosecution of leaders of the Ku Klux Klan for threatening revengeance, in their words, at some indefinite future time, because the risk of harm from the speech was simply too remote. And Cohn versus California refused to permit the prosecution of a young man who wore a jacket emblazoned with the words, "Fuck the draft," into a California courthouse, holding that speech could not be censored merely because it was offensive to certain hearers. Now, it's an honor, a real honor, for me and I think for all of us, to have in the audience tonight my longtime friend and valued colleague, Norman Dorson, who wrote the ACLU brief in Brandenburg and who worked on the ACLU brief in Cohn versus California, the two cases that moved free speech into the modern era. We owe him a great debt of gratitude for a remarkable career spent in defense of the Bill of Rights. Thank you, Norman. After I finished with Brandenburg and Cohn, I would then describe a remarkable bipartisan era of First Amendment good feeling that existed from 1970 to 2000, leading to bipartisan First Amendment protection of unlimited campaign spending by wealthy, by the wealthy, bipartisan First Amendment protection of commercial advertising, bipartisan First Amendment protection of the mass media against government regulations designed to introduce new voices, bipartisan limits on prosecuting hate speech, and bipartisan support for recognizing First Amendment protection for symbolically burning an American flag. I would then describe the erosion of the bipartisan consensus during the first decade of the 21st century. Cases involving Republican-imposed limitations on free speech by public employees, free speech by high school students, and free speech by labor unions, and Democratic opposition to campaign finance decisions empowering corporations to spend unlimited sums on elections, and preventing public financing schemes from providing matching funds to publicly subsidized candidates to enable them to compete with wealth of privately funded candidates. I'd stress the current difference between the Republican deregulatory approach to the First Amendment, which simply takes the government out of the process of regulating speech, leaves a power vacuum, and then doesn't ask who crawls into that power vacuum, even though we all know what, when you create a deregulatory power vacuum, very powerful private entities will enter that vacuum and operate without the possibility of government control. And that's essentially what the deregulatory Republican First Amendment means. And a Democratic aspirational First Amendment that looks at the First Amendment as a goal, as a hope, as an effort to establish an ideal a community of speakers, and that would be therefore amenable to more regulation in order to create more speech and a more ideal speech environment. And finally, I'd stress the power of the consensus constitution that emerged from Brandenburg versus Ohio and Cohn versus California, and illustrate its force by describing three recent bipartisan First Amendment cases protecting lying about winning the Congressional Medal of Honor, demonstrating offensively near the funeral of a fallen American soldier, and selling violent video games to children. That's the lecture I'd give up the street at the NYU Law School, and I ask only one thing of you. Do not tell the dean but I was able to summarize that lecture in 5 minutes. I get paid for doing it over 14 weeks. And if he knew I could do it in five minutes, I don't know what would happen. The other, much less traditional lecture, omits the detailed description of First Amendment doctrine. Instead, it asks whether our current approach to reading the First Amendment, indeed the entire Bill of Rights, as a series of isolated words and clauses. And that's what we do. We pluck a word out, we pluck a clause out, we hold it in our hands, and that's what we look at when we ask judges to enforce the document. Blinds us to the possibility of poetry. That's right, I said poetry. Poetry in Madison's Bill of Rights, especially his masterwork, the First Amendment. I'd ask whether recovering Madison's music, if it exists, could change the court's approach to hard First Amendment cases under all three of our constitutions, Republican, Democratic, or consensus. And I'm going to take advantage of the historic link between this great hall and the lure of new ideas, something I think that Jay Islin would applaud, and choose the lecture less traveled by. Tonight, we'll search for Madison's lost music in the complete text of the Bill of Rights, especially the six luminous ideas embedded in the text of the First Amendment. Now, we honor James Madison as the driving force behind the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, especially the First Amendment. We recognize him as Thomas Jefferson's indispensable political lieutenant. We applaud him as the nation's fourth president, but we will not do Madison full justice until we revere him as a great national poet. Not a literary poet like Emily Dickinson, Wallace Stevens, or Robert Frost, or a prophet poet like Abraham Lincoln or Martin Luther King, or even a people's poet like Ben Franklin, FDR, Ronald Reagan, or Bill Clinton. Madison's poetic genius was structural, a mastery of the contrapuntal interplay between the collective practice of democracy and individual liberty. His poetic voice speaks to us in the harmony of the 462 words, 31 ideas, and 10 amendments, each in its perfectly chosen place, and all interacting to form a coherent whole that is the magnificent poem to freedom called the Bill of Rights. When we read a great literary poem, like Wallace Stevens, "The House Was Quiet and the World Was Calm," his magnificent celebration of the miracle of reading, we concentrate deeply on each word, and we pay particular attention to the rhythmic cadence of the language and stanzas and to the imagery they spin. Let me read you that poem. "The house was quiet and the world was calm. The reader became the book. And summer night was like the conscious being of the book. The house was quiet and the world was calm. The words were spoken as if there was no book, except that the reader leaned above the page, wanted to lean, wanted much most to be the scholar to whom his book was true, to whom the summer night is like a perfection of thought. The house was quiet because it had to be. The quiet was part of the meaning, part of the mind, the access of perfection to the page, and the world was calm. The truth in a calm world in which there is no other meaning, itself is calm. Itself is summer and night. Itself is the reader leaning late and reading there." Now, the magical quality of "The House Was Quiet" is not merely its 141 words and its elegant phrases. Wallace Stevens achieves great poetry in the interplay between and among his words, in the capacity of their order, rhythm, cadence, and imagery to generate meaning and mood that enriches and ennobles the plain text, imbuing it with a kind of music. What if we read Madison's Bill of Rights, especially the First Amendment, with the same respect and intensity that we lavish on a Wallace Stevens poem, paying close attention not only to the individual words and phrases of the first 10 amendments, but to their interplay, order, cadence, and imagery? Would we find the music of poetry in Madison's handiwork, I have no doubt that the answer is yes. Today we hear only broken fragments of Madison's music. Instead of a poem, we read our most revered political text as though the founders had thrown a pot of ink at the wall, with the order of the words, ideas, and amendments randomly fixed by the spat, by the splatter. Why did Madison put the First Amendment first? And why does it begin with the two religion clauses? Within the religion clauses, why does the prohibition on government establishment of religion come before the protection of free exercise of religion? Why do the immensely important secular freedoms of speech, press, and assembly follow the two religious freedom clauses in that particular order? And why does the right to petition for redress of grievances bring up the textual rear? We don't even try to understand how freedom of association, a judge-made seventh First Amendment idea, relates to the six textual protections. We don't ask whether other non-textual First Amendment rights, like the right to vote, are hiding in plain sight in the interstices of the First Amendment's text. In short, we close our eyes to the possibility of poetry hiding in plain sight in Madison's great work of political art. And Wallace Stevens' magnificent words, I invite you tonight to rediscover Madison's lost music, to be the scholar to whom Madison's First Amendment is most true, to be the reader leaning late and reading there. Now, it's easy to dress the First Amendment up to look like a poem. I could probably publish the phone book in blank verse. But is there a deep structure in the text worthy of being called poetic? My answer is an emphatic yes. Madison begins the Bill of Rights with six textual ideas grouped in a First Amendment describing the ideal city on the hill that he hoped to found, a place of religious toleration, respect for conscience, intellectual and political openness, and robust self-government. Madison's First Amendment is a milestone in political thought, marking the first time in human history that the six foundational ideas, separation of church and state, freedom to worship, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, and freedom to petition for redress of grievances, were linked together in a single rights-bearing text. Now, it's not like any of those six ideas were new or particularly original. All had appeared repeatedly, albeit fragmentarily and in random order, in one or another of the 25 rights-bearing documents, beginning with the Magna Carta, that had preceded our Bill of Rights. But it took Madison's organizational genius to meld the six ideas into a coherent formula for a functioning democratic political system. Not only do the six textual ideas in the First Amendment constitute the intellectual building blocks of the founders' ideal commonwealth, the careful order of their placement is a blueprint for democratic self-governance. Madison's First Amendment is organized horizontally as the half-life of a democratic idea. Madison begins with the Establishment and Free Exercise Clauses in the interior recesses of the conscience of a free man or woman, and progresses through three concentric circles of increasingly extensive interactions between the individual and the community, speech, press, and assembly, culminating in a citizen's formal participation in democratic self-governance by petitioning for redress of grievances. Madison's music begins where it must, in the deepest recesses of conscience, with the Establishment Clause guarantee against being forced to support a religion in which you do not believe. The text then moves naturally from the intensely inward-looking protection against compelled belief provided by the Establishment Clause to the more outward-looking freedom to exercise religion freely among your fellow citizens. With the interior precincts of conscience secure, Madison's poem naturally turns to the third textual idea, freedom of speech. As with the free exercise of religion, the free speech clause looks both inward and outward. The inward-looking aspect of the speech clause recognizes that robust democratic politics begins with respect for a free citizen's dignity and sense of self. without asking whether the particular expression has any particular value to the community. Its outward-looking sweep protects the free flow of information, opinion, and ideas needed for the proper functioning of institutions predicated on free choice, like democracy and the free market. Not surprisingly, the Janus-like speech clause presages the two modern justifications for free speech protection: dignitary respect for the individual's freedom to think and speak as he likes, and instrumental understanding of the importance of free speech to the functioning of democratic institutions. There is, however, a limit to the audience that a single voice, however impassioned and compelling, can command. In response to that limit, Madison's poem invokes a fourth textual idea, freedom of the press, to assure the institutional capacity to achieve a broader dissemination of an individual's expression. With conscience, individual expression, and mass communication protected, Madison's poem turns naturally to efforts by individuals to assemble together in the collective service of an idea. Madison called it freedom of assembly. Madison's Odyssey of a Democratic Idea closes with the petition clause, assuring the right to interact with government to seek redress of grievances. Thus, the First Amendment tracks a democratic idea from its genesis in the interior resources of a free citizen's conscience through concentric circles of increased interaction with the community, through public expression, through freedom of speech, mass dissemination, through freedom of the press, collective consideration and adoption, through freedom of assembly, and culminating in formal participation in the democratic process by petitioning redress for grievances. Now, I wasn't there when Madison wrote this. Norman was, but I wasn't there. I wasn't there when Madison wrote this. But I'm telling, I hope you agree with me, it can't have been random. It is not random that the First Amendment is organized so carefully as a blueprint for a functioning democracy. This is a message to us from the founders that the purpose of the First Amendment is to enable us to live as free citizens in a functioning, robust democracy. I think, based on that, for me, the next possible step would be to add an eighth non-textual idea to the First Amendment as the logical culmination of the text, just as Justice Harlan in 1958 added a seventh non-textual idea, freedom of association, to complete the logical dynamic of freedom of assembly. If we added a right to vote to the First Amendment, much of last week's lecture would have become unnecessary. We would have a very different law of the constitutional law of democracy if participation were seen to be a freestanding First Amendment right. And Madison's music tells us that we should seriously consider taking that very important step. Madison also realized that cities perched on hills are notoriously fragile. He understood that it wouldn't be enough just to erect a parchment barrier describing a tolerant, intellectually open democracy. Practical defenses had to be put in place to protect the parchment rights from inevitable attack and erosion. The Second through the Eighth Amendments lay out those defenses in a precisely organized catalog of 25 ideas, surveying the principal risks to the city on the hill, organizing the risks by type and order of magnitude, and putting structural antidotes in place designed to minimize each risk. For example, the placement of the Second and Third Amendments immediately after the iconic First reflects Madison's understanding that military overthrow was and is the fate of most fledgling democracies. With the risk, the Second Amendment, and in the fifth lecture, I hope to make this point to you, the Second Amendment is an amendment designed to avoid military overthrow. And we'll see how it might be read in the modern era to achieve the purpose that Madison's music placed it into the Constitution to achieve. And with the risk of forcible overthrow of by military dealt with in the Second and Third Amendment, Madison turned to the next most feared risk, abuse of the law enforcement power. The Fourth, Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth Amendments track the phases of the law enforcement power in precise chronological order. Investigation in the Fourth, arrest in the Fourth, interrogation in the Fifth, accusation in the Fifth, adjudication in the Sixth and Seventh, and sentencing in the Eighth. And they sent out structural antidotes for each potential abuse in that situation. That could not have been random. There is not in any other rights-bearing document in the world a statement of that kind of chronological and carefully organized conception of how the criminal justice process operates and what the risks are from such a process to a functioning democracy. And then finally, the Ninth and Tenth Amendments close the Bill of Rights by instructing future generations how to read the great constitutional poem. I'll attempt in the Ninth and Tenth Amendments, Ninth and Tenth Lectures. Any of you who are still around then will get lollipops and presents. I plan to be there. In the Ninth and Tenth Lectures, we're going to talk about how the Ninth and Tenth Amendments particularly operate in the Bill of Rights. But for the purposes today, it's enough to say that the Ninth Amendment instructs us to construe the Constitution generously, using sometimes analogy and implication, to find rights that are needed for a functioning democratic society. And the Tenth Amendment tells us to construe the Constitution narrowly and never find powers that the government has through implication or analogy. Those powers have to be written down in the text. The lesson that Madison gives us to read the text broadly when rights are at stake and narrowly when powers are at stake may be the single wisest thing in the entire document. Now, I know such, if you take the horizontal organization of the First Amendment and the vertical organization of the Ten Bill of Rights, you see the operation of an animating intelligence that was poetic in nature, because every single word is where it should be. Every single comma is where it should be to tell a great story of the functioning of a free and robust democracy protected against the dangers that Madison foresaw. No such carefully organized category of rights, risks, and safeguards exists in our rights-bearing heritage or anywhere else. Now, tonight and next week in Lecture 4, dealing with religious freedom, I want to ask how our understanding of the First Amendment might be enriched by reading the text poetically, the way Madison and his helpers wrote it. But first, why? Why do I care? Is this just an aesthetic exercise, or could it really have bite? Could it really have could it change things if we induced people to read the text poetically instead of reading it as an isolated set of words and clauses? I think it's much more than an exercise in aesthetics. We pay two very heavy practical prices for ignoring the poetry latent in the Bill of Rights. We deprive ourselves of the rhetorical power of poetry to rally public support for freedom in times of crisis, and we deprive our judges of a rich interpretive tool in seeking to apply the often ambiguous text to the protean vagaries of daily life. We like to think of the Bill of Rights as a self-propelled legal machine, but history, logic, and common sense teaches us that the First Amendment does not operate on autopilot. Its real-world effectiveness depends on broad public understanding and support for the values it catalogs, and on wise judicial readings of its necessarily abstract and ambiguous terms. I mean, given human nature and the limitations of language, many believe that the First Amendment seeks to do the impossible. They believe that the rights of the weak can never be effectively protected against the tyranny of the strong, especially in times of crisis, by something as ephemeral as a parchment barrier enforced by human beings sitting as judges. And unfortunately, the critics have a point. The Constitution has too often failed to protect vulnerable individuals in times of fear and crisis. And the ink wasn't dry on the First Amendment in 1798, when John Adams arrested the editors of 17 of the 20 newspapers most strongly supportive of Jefferson and critical of Adams. 10 went to prison. Benjamin Franklin's 29-year-old grandson, Benjamin Franklin Bache, the editor of the fiercely partisan Philadelphia Aurora, died in jail while awaiting trial. Matthew Lyon, Vermont's only congressman, was reelected while serving a four-month prison sentence for criticizing the president. Abraham Lincoln imprisoned critics of the Emancipation Proclamation. He jailed opponents of military action against the South and closed hostile newspapers. Labor organizers were arrested and jailed throughout the last decades of the 19th and early decades of the 20th century. Vocal opponents of the draft and the war were jailed during and after World War II. In Korematsu versus the United States, the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of military orders, forcing more than 130,000 innocent Japanese Americans, citizens and lawful permanent residents alike, into internment camps during World War II. No similar wartime programs were even considered for the nation's German or Italian communities. We feign astonishment today that we could have been so racist, but the infamous Korematsu opinion was supported by FDR and Earl Warren, written by Hugo Black, and joined by William O. Douglas. In fact, the Black and Douglas were the swing votes in a 6-3 decision. During the McCarthy years, 93 leaders of the American Communist Party went to jail, not for anything they actually did, but simply for leading a lawful political party pledged to the violent overthrow of capitalism at some indefinite point in the future. During the Vietnam era, young men who burned their draft cards in public to express opposition to an unconstitutional war went to prison as convicted felons. Today, we still can't buy Cuban magazines and newspapers without government permission or visit Havana without a special visa. Idealistic Americans are forbidden on pain of going to prison from teaching peaceful methods of resolving grievances to foreign groups labeled as terrorists. And despite the First Amendment's right to political anonymity and the Fourth Amendment's right of personal privacy, the promise of protection against government political snooping is in absolute shambles. Now, I must confess to you, sometimes, usually just after I've lost a case, I succumb to what I call the deck chair theory of constitutional law. I grumble that when the weather is sunny, we unfold an elegant desk chair we call the First Amendment. And we lounge in our comfortable chair, enjoying the sun. We extol the chair's comfort. We talk about its sophisticated design. And we congratulate ourselves for owning such a useful piece of furniture. At the first sign of rain, though, we fold the deck chair up and put it away until the sun comes out again. Now, could it be, I ask myself, that the real reason the First Amendment has endured for more than 200 years is that it's never gotten wet? When I emerge from my funk, as it usually takes me about 2 or 3 days after I've lost a case to emerge from my funk. I've gotten very good at it because I've had a lot of practice. I remember that the historical record is much more complex. I remember that the story of our past is not just a cynical tale of the First Amendment as a deck chair for sunny days. I remember that in each period of crisis, brave voices have rallied to the Bill of Rights. Adams jailed his critics, but the people rejected the Alien and Sedition Acts in the election of 1800. Congress declined to renew it in 1802, and President Jefferson pardoned the victims. I remember that President Lincoln tolerated a huge amount of dissent and criticism during the Civil War, presiding fairly over a hard-fought 1864 presidential election where he was vigorously challenged by George McClellan, one of his ex-generals. I remember that the World War I prosecutions of war resistors like Eugene Debs eventually impelled Justice Holmes and Brandeis to issue the dissents that lit the way to the modern First Amendment. I remember that on the very day the Supreme Court upheld the Japanese internment camps in Korematsu, it ruled in ex parte endo that every detainee must be given a prompt individual hearing on dangerousness, dooming the camps and leading to their prompt closing within months. I remember that the Supreme Court eventually blunted some of the worst excesses of the McCarthy years, and it was Joe McCarthy who was eventually censored by the Senate. I remember that the Supreme Court refused to permit the president to block the Pentagon Papers. And that popular opposition to the war in Vietnam drove a sitting president from office, hastening the end of the carnage. Finally, I remember that despite occasional blips, the current scope and intensity of our First Amendment freedoms is remarkably broad. It turns out that the real lesson of our First Amendment history is that the Bill of Rights, without popular support, is too often a toothless parchment barrier. But a rights-bearing document backed by popular support can move mountains. That's where the loss of Madison's poetry hurts most deeply. The aesthetic force of Madison's lost music would be of incalculable value in rallying the level of public support needed to sustain the practical vitality of the Bill of Rights, especially the First Amendment, in storm-tossed times. Madison's music would also speak to judges, helping them to act wisely in exercising our greatest contribution to democratic political theory, reliance on politically insulated judges to protect individual rights against majoritarian tyranny. I don't for a minute claim that recovering Madison's lost music would drain values and uncertainty from judicial review. I do believe, though, that understanding the Bill of Rights, especially the First Amendment, as an integrated document, instead of as a set of randomly ordered commands, can be of substantial help to a judge who is seeking to read the document in a principled manner. So how might Madison's music make a real difference in the meaning of the Constitution, in the meaning of the First Amendment? Under the consensus Constitution's First Amendment, five kinds of people live in Mr. Madison's neighborhood: speakers, hearers, conduits, who are often media giants who carry the speech of someone else to a larger audience, government regulators — you can tell the government regulators by their shifty eyes and their black hats — and speech targets, the subjects of the speech in question. So we've got speakers, hearers, conduits, government regulators, and speech targets. Now, the interplay between and among the five kinds of people who live in Mr. Madison's neighborhood is what gives free speech law its contents and structure at any particular point in time. Now, under existing First Amendment doctrine, speakers are the neighborhood aristocrats. Most First Amendment theory and doctrine is unabashedly speaker-centered, relying on Kantian notions of a speaker's dignity and the instrumental need for a free flow of speech needed to inform hearers. Hearers are the neighborhood shopkeepers. They're important, but they're a full cut under the aristocrats, under the speakers. Under the consensus Constitution, when the interests of speakers and hearers collide, the edge usually, almost always, goes to speakers. Hearers have almost no right to be free from hateful or deeply disturbing speech. Conduits like cable broadcasters and Rupert Murdoch and his friends have managed to persuade the court that they are really speakers, so they get to pretend that they're aristocrats as well. Speech targets are the neighborhood slum dwellers. Their interests are always trumped by the needs of speakers and hearers. You don't care if the speech libels somebody or if it says some terrible things about somebody. Their interests don't matter. They're always trumped. They're the slum dwellers. And government regulators are the neighborhood motorcycle gang. They're prone to terrorizing the residents unless they're carefully policed. Would listening to Madison's music affect the interactions in the neighborhood? Let's take a look at some recent cases and try to see. Under the consensus Constitution, the government speech regulator in Mr. Madison's neighborhood has a thankless task. In order to do her job under Brandenburg and Cohn, the regulator must demonstrate a compelling governmental interest in suppressing or regulating speech, including symbolic behavior like burning a flag, spending money on an election, or participating in a mass demonstration, And she has to prove that she's not being motivated by hostility to the speech's content, that the speech involves imminent, almost certain threat of harm flowing from the speech, and that the government interest can't be protected by any less drastic means. It's a rare government speech regulation that can survive such a triple whammy, especially since under Cone v. California and the flag-burning cases, the interests of hearers or speech targets usually don't count for much. Not only that, the speech regulator is so mistrusted that she must operate within narrow procedural ground rules that require her to treat all similarly situated speakers exactly the same, that she has to avoid prior restraints, operate pursuant to precisely defined rules that give speakers full notice of the speech that's at risk of regulation, and that manage to stop precisely at the boundary between speech that can be regulated and speech that can't. Failure to abide the procedural ground rules often means that the speaker goes free, even if the speech itself would satisfy all the requirements for regulation. For example, let's take a look at some actual cases and see how they operate inside Mr. Madison's neighborhood. Suppose some lowlife gets elected to a local governing board and promptly announces at the first meeting that he's been awarded a Congressional Medal of Honor for bravery. Only he's lying through his teeth. If the speech regulator arrests the liar for violating a criminal statute that forbids lying about receiving a Congressional Medal of Honor, under current ground rules, two Democratic and two Republican justices will immediately order his release under the consensus constitution because, in the justices' opinion, the government lacks a sufficiently compelling interest in preventing lies about receiving the Congressional Medal of Honor. Two more justices, both Democrats, will agree that in general the government's interest in preventing a lie is not significant enough to warrant putting liars in jail unless the government also proves that the liar actually benefited from the lie or that someone was hurt by the lie. Now, in this particular case, the liar obviously benefited from the lie. He was attempting to increase his political clout as a member of the local board. But since the statute didn't require it, then the procedural rules kicked in, and they said, well, it doesn't matter that he happened to benefit in this case. The statute would allow prosecution for people who didn't benefit. And therefore, the six majority justices strike the statute down, say the liar goes free, and ignore the hearer's interest in not being lied to, and remind us with a straight face, mind you, that even liars have a Kantian dignity to construct their personality through lies. At bottom, I think Alvarez, that's the name of the case, rests less on Kant than on mistrust of the government censor. Both the Republican and Democratic justices fear that if lies could be the basis for punishing speakers without also having to prove harm or gain, government would have a potent weapon to terrorize dissidents. Maybe they're right. Here's another example. Suppose anti-gay religious fanatics decide to demonstrate on a public sidewalk near the funeral of an American soldier who died in Afghanistan. The demonstrators wave signs saying, "Thank God for dead soldiers," and insist that the soldier's death was God's vengeance on America for tolerating homosexuality. If the speech regulator orders the demonstrators to pay damages to the soldier's family for intentionally inflicting emotional distress on them in a moment of awful grief, eight bipartisan members of the Supreme Court will order the regulator to give the money back because the demonstrators were expressing themselves on a public issue in a public place, triggering Kantian concerns for individual dignity and the instrumental commitment to a free market idea in ideas, even crackpot ideas. According to the eight justices, the psychological pain experienced by the family, who couldn't see the demonstrators but who knew that they were there, cannot justify a damage award. The eight justices were concerned that if a hearer's hurt feelings could justify censorship, a huge loophole would be opened in robust free speech protection. And they have a point. In fact, that's how the Russian courts, egged on by President Putin, have justified the 2-year prison sentence meted out to the members of Pussy Riot who demonstrated against Putin in a Russian Orthodox church. They were jailed for 2 years for outraging religious sensibilities. But completely ignoring the dignitary interest of hearers is what makes it possible for crackpots to burn Qurans and make videos denigrating Muhammad without the possibility of any governmental response. In the modern world, people die as the result of such speech. But under the consensus constitution, the government speech regulator is powerless to act against it. Under the consensus constitution, a woman seeking medical assistance in terminating a pregnancy may be forced to run a gauntlet of angry anti-abortion demonstrators who vilify her, call her a murderer, and thrust deeply disturbing images at her as she attempts to make her way into a clinic to exercise her constitutionally protected right to choose. The only thing a speech regulator can do is to tell the speakers to stand 6 or 7 feet away from the woman as she makes her way through a tunnel of hate in an effort to exercise her constitutional right to choose. Finally, supposing somebody sells violent video games to children that engage child players in day-long fantasy reenactments of rape, violence, and murder. If the speech regulator forbids the sale of the violent games to minors, 2 Republican and 3 Democratic justices will lift the ban immediately, because according to the 5 justices, playing violent video games is a protected form of speech equivalent to reading Dante's Inferno, which after all also depicts violence. Since in the view of the bipartisan majority of justices, playing video games is a form of deeply protected speech like reading. Can you imagine Wallace Stevens writing, leaning late and playing video games there? Government must prove not merely a plausible fear that violent games may harm the child players, but demonstrate a virtual certainty that serious harm to the child is likely to occur and that no other means exist to prevent the harm. 2 other Republican justices will also order the ban lifted because the law's definition of a violent video game is too vague. According to those 2 justices, Kant would have wanted the makers of violent video games to have precise notice of how close to the line they can go in depicting sex, rape, and violence to minors. The starkest difference between the Republic, so that's the consensus constitution, that's the modern consensus constitution going on in Mr. Madison's neighborhood. The starkest differences between the Republican and Democratic free speech clauses occur in the campaign finance and public employee free speech cases. In Citizens United, 5 Republican justices ruled that multi-shareholder corporations, profit-making corporations, can expend unlimited sums in an effort to affect an election. They said the real beneficiaries here are the hearers, not the corporation, because the hearers will benefit by getting more speech. No one bothered to ask the hearers whether they wanted to have more speech. The 4 Democratic justices dissented, arguing that for-profit corporations should not be protected speakers under the First Amendment, and that hearers would actually risk being harmed by a one-sided election barrage by incredibly wealthy, profit-driven corporations. In Garcetti, the other case, an assistant district attorney criticized his boss publicly for allegedly relying on a search warrant known to contain false assertions. The 5-justice Republican majority held that the speech was not protected by the First Amendment because it might adversely affect the efficiency of the DA's office. The 4 Democratic justices dissented, arguing that the public's right to know required protection for whistleblower speech. You will never see clearer examples of the Republican and Democratic value hierarchies in action than the 5-4 decisions in Citizens United and Garcetti. So let me close by saying, what would listening to Madison's music affect the interactions in Mr. Madison's speech neighborhood? At a minimum, recognizing the structure of the First Amendment as a blueprint for democracy should cause a reconsideration of the dysfunctional democracy cases we discussed last week, like Buckley and Citizens United. It should also stimulate real thought over whether there is a non-textual First Amendment right to vote. If participating in democracy is a First Amendment right, much of the dysfunction that we described last week would disappear. It should also stimulate thought on the very hard question about whether the dignitary interest of hearers, after all, Kant was talking about not speakers, but human beings, and hearers are human beings too, and they have Kantian dignity just like speakers do. Whether the dignitary interest of hearers to be free from certain speech is being adequately respected. Here's a line I'm really proud of, so listen carefully. Kant can't be a one-way street in Mr. Madison's neighborhood. Took me weeks to come up with that. Similarly, it frees us to consider whether conduits, and this is also tremendously important, whether conduits should continue to masquerade as speakers. They don't generate the speech, they just carry the speech of others. If the purpose of the First Amendment is to assure a robust, ideal First Amendment environment in a robust, functioning democracy, what's the big deal about asking a conduit to carry some more speech? So that other voices can be heard. Why not tell the media that free TV time in a campaign is necessary? And that that's what you have to do because you're a conduit, just like the phone company is a conduit. And stop dressing them up as though they're full-scale First Amendment speakers. Finally, it should make us reconsider something very important, something that I think is at the heart of American free speech law. And that's treating speech regulators as though they're motorcycle gang members, that they have to be very careful. You give them any traction and they'll terrorize the neighborhood. When a speech regulator is trying to protect the dignity of hearers or targets, or trying to enhance the capacity of a robust democratic society to operate within fair understandable limits, the analysis should turn on whether the proposed rule actually respects the dignity of a hearer, whether it helps or hurts an excellent democracy, and not solely on whether it empowers future evil regulators to act improperly. After all, that's what we have judges for, to stop the future evil regulators. It makes no sense, I think, to say that good regulation now has to be foregone because someday we might have bad regulation. And yet, that's the way we treat the government speech regulator with her black hat and her shifty eyes. Maybe, just maybe, it's time for a little poetry-driven urban renewal in Mr. Madison's neighborhood. Thank you. So, according to my mentor, Norman, it's now 7:30, and anybody who wants to can go home, because the one thing he taught me is you never keep an audience longer than the audience signed on to be kept. Hearers have rights, too. So seriously, if anybody wants to leave now, by all means do so. I'm happy to take some questions at the mics up at the beginning, beginning of the aisle. Any speech with no questions is a great success. Thank you very much for coming. Wait. I knew I wasn't going to get away with it.
First of all, I'm the person that Bert said was present when the Bill of Rights was formulated.
You want to deny that, or shall I have to cross-examine you?
My question about that is, how did you get it so accurately? From my recollection, that was exactly what Madison had in mind.
Well, it's because like Bill Brennan, like in my first lecture, remember how I explained to you how Brennan justified a living constitution? That he took the founders, rotated them forward 200 years, sat them down at his desk, and asked them what they wanted in the current era. And I said, remarkably, the founders always told Brennan just what Brennan thought should happen. I did the same thing. I summoned up Madison and I talked to him. He said nice things about you, by the way.
Thank you. My second comment is, how did you know so much? How do you know so much? I remember you as a New York Civil Liberties Union lawyer, rather young and callow, and I was brought in to keep an eye on you. But here you are, a remarkably erudite person, and I'm very proud of you.
Thank you, Norman.
Now, My real substantive comment is, and I perhaps should have mentioned that when you refer to it in our private conversations, that there's something about characterizing the constitutions as Republican and Democrat that troubles me. Earl Warren was a Republican. Harry Blackmun was a Republican. John Paul Stevens is a Republican. David Souter is a Republican. There are many Democrats I could mention, Reed, Vinson, Minton, who are very, very conservative. Yeah. And that in a serious way now, tends to politicize the view of the Constitution. Even in the Senate, as you know very well, in the 1970s and 80s, Republicans like Mathias and Case and Scott and Hatfield and Margaret Chase Smith were the greatest allies of the ACLU.
Yeah.
So I'm a little troubled by that.
Give me one sec to answer that, because it's an important point. It's a point that I tried to make, those of you who were at the first lecture, remember. What I said is that the modern Republican and Democratic parties are very different from the parties that existed in mid-century, at the point that you were talking about. At mid-century, neither Republican nor Democratic Party had a really fixed ideological base. In fact, there were conservative Republicans, liberal Republicans, conservative Democrats, liberal Democrats. I argued in the first lecture that that liberal Republicans were closer to liberal Democrats in those years than they were to conservatives in either party. And I anointed Warren, Souter, Stevens, not Blackmun, Warren, Stevens, Souter, and a draft choice to be named later. I anointed them as honorary Democrats because they were using value orientations that today I think would be Democratic. And there's a wonderful piece in Stevens' recent little biography. Stevens wrote a great memoir of serving under five chief justices. And he says that as a boy, the first election he ever voted in, I think it was 1948, was Truman Dewey. And he said he voted for Dewey because that's what his family always did, but he listened to the returns and rooted for Truman. So I said, okay, he's an honorary Democrat. Earl Warren is an honorary Democrat. When Earl Warren resigned from the bench in 1968, he called Lyndon Baines Johnson and said, I'm resigning. I don't want Nixon to be able to appoint my successor. So he, and of course they botched it, as Norman and I have talked about this, in the single most important political failure of the 20th century, Johnson could not engineer the successor to Earl Warren, even though he had a Democratic majority, because he chose Abe Fortas, and Abe Fortas turned out not to be worthy of the office. Souter is undoubtedly a Democrat. He comes out of New Hampshire. It was a one-party state when he was there. All there was the Republican Party, but it had two wings. It had a liberal wing and it had a conservative wing. Souter was a member of the liberal wing. Today, I'm almost certain he'd be a Democrat. So that's my answer. I can dance. Thank you. Thank you. Go home. Thank you very much.